Okay, we're beginning here on Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph by the Mishnah. The Gemara now is moving to a genre of Mishnayot that we actually bumped into in the Gemara in Yevamot, and it's a series of Mishnayot that deal with individuals who pass away in an incident in which we don't know which of the two passed away first. And obviously that has implications because different parties have different claims against the individuals that passed away. And depending upon who passed away first, that would have impact on who is the Yoresh, or who is entitled to the properties over here. So the first of these Mishnayot is Nafala Bayit Alav V'Alaviv. The house collapsed upon him and his father. O Alav V'Al Morishav. Or upon him and someone else who is a bequeather of Yerusha to him. So it's not unique necessarily to a father, but anyone like a father who would grant him rights to the property. V'Alav K'tubat Tisha U'Bal Chov. And the individual, the son over here, or the recipient of the Yerusha, has claimants against him. He has his wife, who has a claim for the ketubah, and he has other creditors that have claims against him. So these claimants have a vested interest in seeing the property reach him, because then they would have a claim against those properties. On the other hand, the yorshim, or the other yorshim here, have a vested interest in seeing it stay with the father, or the morishim, or the bequeathers over here, because then the baal chov and the ketubah tisha would have no rights to those properties. And so they would favor the situation in which he passed away first, and then the father passed away afterwards. So in a scenario where you have Yaakov and Reuven together in a house, and now the house collapses on them. Reuven has a ketubat tisha who has a claim against him, creditor that has a claim against him, and then they both passed away. Yaakov has all this property that he's going to bequeath to his son. So if Yaakov passed away first, and then the properties went to Reuven, these claimants would have precedence and would have the ability to collect from those properties. Because they think that the father died first, Yaakov, and then Reuven collected the property. And only after Reuven died, and they have collected what they are entitled to, can the Yorshim come in and take the residual. On the other hand, the Yorshim say that it was just the opposite way around. Now, the Yorshim here can be either the sons of Yaakov, meaning that the other children of Yaakov besides Reuven, Shimon, Levi, or they could actually be the sons of Reuven, because they will inherit directly from their grandfather, without ever touching their father. Because even though their father can pass them that Yerusha in the grave, in actuality, it never goes into his possession. So that if Reuven passed away first, and then Yaakov, the grandfather, has it, Reuven's children, Chanoch u'Falu, can inherit directly from Yaakov, bypassing any of the creditors or the Ketubat Isha. So for them, they would have a vested interest in saying that Reuven passed away first, and then only afterwards Yaakov, because then the Yerusha would come to them, and the claimants, the creditor and the Ketubat Isha, would have no rights over here. And that's what the Mishnah explains now. Yoshea Avumrim, the inheritors of the father say, and again we discussed here, the inheritors of the father could either be the brothers of Reuven, the brothers of Yaakov, or even the children of Reuven. Haben Meit Rishon, Reuven passed away first. V'achar kach Meit Av, and then only afterwards did Yaakov pass away, because in that way, the creditor and the Ketubat Tisha would have no rights over here. U'balei Achov Umreim, and the outstanding creditors, which are the Ketubat Tisha and the Baal Chov, they say Ha'av Meit Rishon, that Yaakov passed away first. V'achar kach Meit Aben. Then only afterwards did Reuven pass away. In that way, the Yerusha passed to Reuven, and they would have an ability to collect from that property for their outstanding loans. Beit Shammai Omrim, so Beit Shammai says the solution to the problem is Yachloku. They split it. Now, we'll explain after we explain Beit Hillel's position, what is Beit Shammai's position. Beit Hillel Omrim, Nechasim Bechazkatan, that the property stays in the Chazakah, and as the Rishbam explains over here, the Chazakah belongs to the inheritors, because the inheritors are Vadai Mukuzakim in the property. Because no matter which way it goes, whether it is that Reuven passed away first, then Yaakov, or Yaakov passed away, and then Reuven, they're entitled Yorshim to the property. So in either instance, they are Vadai going to inherit the property, and therefore they're deemed to be the Mukhzakim in the property. The creditors only have rights in one of those two scenarios. So in essence, they are a Safek. Their Safek takes away their ability to be the Mukhzakim in the property. And therefore, the Yorshim are deemed to be the Mukhzakim in the property. The creditors are the Safek. And Eimos Safek Motzim Bidei Vadai. Or in essence, Motzim Chaveiro Lav Araya. Since the Yorshim have the Chazakah, the creditors will have to bring the proof in order to collect on their outstanding indebtedness. Now, Beit Shammai disagrees because they give more power to the creditors. And that is because of a principle which Beit Shammai subscribed to, which is Shtar Omid LeGavot KeGavui Dami. And when you have an outstanding credit document that is ripe for collection, we consider it as if collected. And so therefore, they're considered to be vadai collectors over here, because we don't say that they have to go and collect. We consider it as if collected. And since it's considered as if collected, that evens out the chazakot over here. And since now they both have, and quote-unquote, vadai claims, they are considered of equal footing, and that's why yachloku, they'll split it. So Beit Hillel, the Yorshim, are the vadai inheritors, because even the claimants or the creditors here only come after the fact to make their claim or to try to claim it. So that means that the Yorshim, by definition, will be in possession of the property no matter which way it goes, and then the creditors will come and make their claim. For Beit Shammai, the creditors' rights are exercised immediately, because as soon as there's indebtedness, it's as if collected. And so therefore, if it went in the direction of the father passing away first and then the son, they would be right there, muchzakim, in the property. They wouldn't have to come make a claim. Their claim is as if collected. And therefore, the difference in who passed away first will impact on who is considered the muchzak over here. And since that's a safek, it is an unresolvable safek. And we will say that they are yachloku. They will split it. Okay, it's not hotam. We have a Mishnah further on the Masechta in the last parak. Hamalvet chaviro bishtar. Someone who lends money to his friend with a document, goveh minichasim mishubadim, then he has a right to collect from encumbered property. This is something we've spoken about numerous times, which is that in their day, the writing of a shtar was considered to be something that had a kol, something that became a public note, and therefore people were aware of the fact that there was outstanding indebtedness here. And if you have people after that fact, either that lend money to this individual or buy property from this individual, we expect them to be aware of the fact that there's outstanding indebtedness that will take precedence over them, and there are creditors who have liens on this property ahead of them. And therefore, they have to take the proper precautions in order to ensure that those parties can collect whatever is theirs and not have to come after them. And if they don't, they're assuming that risk that these creditors might come and take the property away from them, and they will have to make a requisite adjustment in their remuneration that they are paying because of that risk. There's a Rishpam notes that we paskin that achrayut nechasim is a taut sofer, which means that even if it's absent from the contract, we assume that that is what a shtar has, and there's automatically achrayut nechasim, even though it's not explicitly delineated or documented in the shtar. But ayidei dim, if it is just an oral loan, and even though there are witnesses to the loan, over there, we do not make the assumption that there is a kol, that there is this public note about the fact that there was outstanding indebtedness in here. And therefore, the buyers that come subsequent to that, or other creditors that lend money, are not going to be aware of the first person who lent the money. And therefore, he will not get a lien on the property that will supersede their rights. And that creditor can only collect from B'nai Chorim, free and clear property, not from encumbered property. And again, this goes to the equivalent of what we do today in a title search, which is that we go to make sure before you lend money, before you go into a transaction, as to who is the true owner of the property and if there are any liens outstanding on the property. In their day, they didn't have such a registry. So the registry was things that came into the public sphere. And things that come into the public sphere are only things that are noteworthy or have a kol associated with them. And that kol is generated generally when you have a deem that sign on a shtar. That involves a certain amount of publicity because you have the sofer, you have the edim, and that publicity causes it that the information then is disseminated to the public at large, which is not true when you have a simple oral loan where it's done quietly, especially if there are no edim. But even if there are edim, it's still not considered to be something of a public nature. And therefore, the rights are different in these cases, which is in the case where it's done in the shtar, you have rights to collect even from encumbered property. Whereas if it is done without a shtar, you only have rights to collect from free and clear property. So by Yishmuel, Shmuel asks the following question, and eventually we'll get back to our Mishnah and why the sugya is found here. De ikne, if in the shtar it includes the language that I have a lien on your property, not only properties that you own currently, but even properties that you will acquire in the future, which is that you have a language that reads somewhere along the lines, de kanai, things that you already own, udatida nila miknei, and things that I will acquire in the future. So the lien not only exists for existing property or existing assets, but also extends to assets that will be acquired in the future. Vikana, and sure enough, he goes ahead and he buys other assets in the future. Mahu, what is the din? Meaning, does the lien extend onto those new assets. Do you have a right to establish such a encumbrance by which you'll have a lien even on future acquisitions or future properties? So I'll leave it to Rabbi Meir, according to Rabbi Meir, who believes Damar Adam Makneh Davar Shelo Bad Olam, who says that you can transact in items that don't exist in the world, or that you can transact in these items that have yet to come into the world. Lo Tibay Eloch. Over there, you don't have any question. Devadai Kana. That you're certainly successful if you can transact. And the classic example is that you purchase fruits that will grow on a tree. So if you can purchase those fruits that grow on the tree, certainly you can extend a lien onto properties that you will acquire in the future. Now, even though we know, and Bali Tosfot note this about Rabbi Meir's position, that many Amoraim qualify Rabbi Meir's position and say the following, that Rabbi Meir only says this, k'mon pered deko, davidu de'atu, that these are things that automatically come or come about by themselves. And over here, you don't have that. The lien is on properties that will possibly be bought, aren't necessarily going to be bought. And therefore, how can you say automatically, just because you hold the Rabbi Meir, that Adam Makneh Davar Shelo Bad Olam, that doesn't mean that you should also automatically have a lien be extended onto new properties that are bought? So the Balei Tosafot say over here, V'yesh Lomar, the Modi Rabbi Meir, Baha, Rabbi Meir agrees in this case, the Shibur Chal Memeilo, that the Shibur comes about by itself, passively. Afo Pish, the Gabi Kinyan, Loya Lola Hoyol Kan. So even though when it comes to a kinyan in this type of situation, if you transacted about the future property, it would not be effective because it's different than the payroll deco, which come automatically. If you transact about properties that you acquire in the future, those aren't necessarily a given, or those aren't necessarily something that must come about. And therefore, maybe Rabbi Meir would say that the kinyan is unsuccessful. But with regards to a shibud, which happens passively, it happens by itself, we're going to say that that is similar in nature to the idea of peirot growing on a tree, whereby we can assume that they're going to come because it happens by itself. So too, the shibud would extend itself by itself. That's one way to express it. The Rashbam also brings two other possibilities of how to express this. One is the kaven that peirot dekel adayin lo ba'u le'olam kana, even though the peirot dekel have yet to exist in the world, and Rabbi Meir still says that you're able to acquire them. When it comes to the karka that already exists in the world, then for sure we're going to say that you have the ability to transact or to deal with them. It just happens to be it's not in his possession, but it's in the world. So the way that the Rashbam overcomes the problem, and again, the Balei Tosafot's question is still relevant, but the way that the Rashbam says that we overcome the problem is to say that Rabbi Meir is speaking about even in cases where the item doesn't exist at all in the world, and yet he still says you can transact. Over here where the karka exists in the world, it's just not in the possession of the debtor. So there for sure, Rabbi Meir will say that the transaction is able to go through. Or he brings another possibility, which is the fact that Amur Rabbonon the Shibud Yoter Mikinyan, that the Chachamim over here instituted that the liens would take on a greater power than Kinyanim in general. In order not to shut down liquidity in the market, they wanted people to have the rights to extend these liens, even to properties that possibly would not be included under the normal normative law of Adam Makneh Davar Shelo Ba'u Le'Bali Olam. They allowed the liens to do that in order to facilitate the ability for creditors to lend, debtors to borrow, because they wouldn't do it if they couldn't get this lien to extend onto future assets of the debtor. So here you have three different perspectives on why Rabbi Meir, who says that a person can be at Makneh Davar Shelo Ba'u Le'Olam, would also apply over here. Those reasons are all important because we're going to see in a second that the Gemara entertains the possibility that the Chachamim would agree in this case as well. And that is, Ela Kiti Bailach, where would you have a question? I'll leave it to Rabbonon. That would be according to the Rabbonon, Damrei Ena Adam Makneh Davar Shelo Ba'u Le'Olam, that you're not allowed to transact in items that have yet to exist. The fruits that will grow on the tree you can't sell because these are items that don't exist yet. According to them, what would you say over here? And the question, of course, is why would you think it's any different over here? So for all the reasons that we just stated before, that's why it possibly would be different over here. And that's what the Rishbam says. It's either because the karka exists in the world, and therefore it's better than the case of the peirot, or because the Chachamim came here and instituted that the shibud should work even stronger than a normal kinyan in order to facilitate liquidity in the lending market. Or again, the Balei Tosafot to say, since it comes, memeilo, the shibud, Maybe there's some reason to believe that that would have more impact in this situation. While others suggest that the reason over here we might think it is different is because Shibud in general works to capture items that the individual doesn't own already. For instance, if you are a creditor to A, and A has credit extended to B, then that loan that he extended to B, you have a right to collect from because of Shibud the Rabbi Natan, which is that your lien on A gives you the right to collect even from the credit that was extended from A to B. So you already have a situation in which a Shibud can capture things that are intangible, things that are coming in the future. So maybe over here as well, the Chachamim will agree that future property that is acquired will also be subject to the Shibud. Or another way to phrase it is to say that the Shibud Nechasim takes place immediately upon purchase of property. And because of the nature of the encumbrance over here, as we're going to see in a second, it's not just simply that you have a right to the property of the individual. The person himself is indebted to you and has an encumbrance to you. And that might forge a situation in which any time or any asset that the person owns becomes like it's a part of himself or his obligation to repay you. So for all those reasons, the Gemara over here wants to know, do the Rabbanon believe that if you use the Iknei, that if you have that language in the contract which says that future assets will be encumbered, is that successful? So Amar Rav Yosef, Tashma. Let us learn it from here. V'chachamim omrim, zeh haya pikeach, shemachalo et akarka mipnei sheyachol d'mashkano alav. This is a situation in the Mishnayot in Ketubot, in which an individual is a creditor to a party. So now he's waiting to get paid back. In the interim, after you already extended credit to this individual, he sells property to the debtor. And the debtor comes along and says, look, he sold me property after he had extended me this loan. That shows you that there must have not been any indebtedness left. Because why would he sell me property if I owed him money? That wouldn't make sense. The fact that he sold me the property means that the debt must have already been taken care of, and that's why he sold me the property. That's the position of Admon. The Chachamim disagree and say, no, that this creditor is really smart. Because this creditor is exchanging property for cash, currency, metaltolin, and in doing so, he now ensures that he has a way to track the assets of the debtor. Prior to this point in time, the debtor could have said, I don't have any money. I don't have any assets. And the creditor had no way to ensure or to prove that that was incorrect. But now that he has sold him the property, he now gets that cash or the liquidation values of that property. But now the debtor is holding the property. And the creditor knows that when he goes to make a claim, he can go get that property because that asset's not going anywhere. Property doesn't walk, doesn't move, and he'll have a right to collect from that property. So the Chachamim say that he did actually something that was wise, which is that he now forced the debtor to show his assets because of the property. But what you see from this is that the only way that would work is that if the creditor had a right for his lien to extend to new assets purchased by the debtor. This is a transaction that took place after the credit was extended. It's something that happened after he lent them the money because he sold them the property subsequent to that. So now we're saying that he has a right or a lien on that property that was sold after the fact. So that would prove that according to the Chachamim, the Iknei, the right to have a shibud or a lien on future properties does work. Amalei, Rabba. The Rabba says something here, which I mentioned before, which is that the nature of shibud is very different. Minei kamar, you're speaking about the debtor himself. Minei, afilu miglima, dial katfei. The responsibility of the debtor to pay back is so strong that the creditor has a lien not only on the property of the debtor, but on the debtor himself. The debtor has personally guaranteed and obligated himself to repay the creditor. That means that the creditor has a right to all of his assets, even to quote-unquote himself, obviously can't take or sell the individual into slavery or do any of those things because the Torah does not allow for that. But nevertheless, the personal obligation means that anything, even something as personal as the jacket that he wears, the cloak that he wears, is encumbered to the creditor over here. And you can see that clearly in the Rabbeinu Gershom. He says, the Baal Chov Gufei Kamart, Tiachod Mashkano, Mashakana, Shuv, Hapshitali, Diminegava. The fact that a Baal Chov encumbers any assets that he brings into his estate after the loan was extended, that's so straightforward. Because even he himself is encumbered. Even without that language added into the contract, the personal obligation of the debtor to repeat pay the debts means that all of his assets are subject to the claim of the creditor. So even if you didn't have the word bikne in there, he would have a right to go after any asset of the debtor because the debtor basically personally guaranteed that he will give it back. And that's what it means. And you may be familiar with the language because that's what's found in the ketubah, that the husband guarantees his wife's ketubah, even with the shirt up of his back, because basically he's now encumbering himself. He is guaranteeing that he will pay back this indebtedness. There it's the ketubah tishal, but here it is, the debtor to the creditor, or we otherwise phrase it from the pasuk, which is eved loved ish malved, that the loved in essence becomes like a servant or an eved to a slave to the malved, because he is now encumbered to pay back everything. So he says, the Rava says, the question here of Shmuel makes no sense in that context, because of course, any assets that the debtor has are subject to the claim of the creditor. So the question, you have to rephrase the question of Shmuel to the following. So in a case where the contract includes the language of diikne, meaning future assets will be encumbered, kana, and the debtor went ahead and purchased property, umachar, and then he sold that property. Diikne, again, a case where the contract includes that language, the future assets will be encumbered, kana, behorish, he acquired the property, and then he bequeathed it to other parties. My, what is the din there? How strong is this lien? We understand when the assets are in his possession, then of course the creditor has a lien and can go after any asset in the possession of the debtor. The problem here is that he acquired an asset post the lending of the money, and then he liquidated that asset or sold that asset, gave away that asset. Now that that asset is gone, does the creditor have a right to go after that asset that is quote-unquote encumbered? It's owned by somebody else now. It is in someone else's possession. Does his lien extend to that property? And that's the nature of Shmuel's question, which is the lien strong enough then to attach itself to the properties acquired to the extent that if they are sold or sent out of the estate in any way, that he can go make a claim and bring them back in? Right, what's the din there? Amra Tano, Tashma. Let us learn from our Mishnah over here, and that's why the sugya is found over here, because of the proof brought from our Mishnah. Nafala Bayit Alav, V'al Aviv. In an instance where the house collapsed on him and his father, Alav V'al Morishav, or a case where it fell upon him or others that would bequeath inheritance to him, it's a situation in which there are outstanding creditors that have a claim against the son or the recipient of the Yerusha. Yosheav Omrim Haben Meit Rishon, the inheritors of the father say that the son died first, Rachakach Meit Av, Reuven passed away, and then only afterwards did Yaakov pass away. Therefore, the creditors have no rights over here. The property all comes to us. And the creditors say, no, it happened the other way around. Ha'av made Rishon, Yaakov died first. And then the Ben, Reuven, inherited him. And therefore, we have a claim against those assets to collect for us. V'isakadatcha de'ikne kana umachar de'ikne kana v'orish lo mishtabed. If you believe that if the language of it de'ikne was included in the contract, and therefore if you buy property and sell it, or you buy property and then bequeath it, that there is no shibud, the lien of the creditors is not meaningful. So then, in the case of the father passed away first, it's a case where the asset came into his possession after the fact, and then right away was given to other parties. So here, in the instance where Yaakov passed away first, Reuven was the inheritor of that asset. That's a new asset in the estate. But then Reuven died, and he passed those to the Yorshim. So it's a case exactly like what we're looking for. It's a case where he acquired an asset after the fact and then disposed of that asset before the creditors could get to it. So if you believe that the creditors have no right to such an asset, then what's the Mishnah speaking about? In the case of our Mishnah, the creditors would have no right to it. If you believe that the lien is not successful at being extended to new assets, even after the assets are sold, then we could say to the creditors, you have no rights here. Even though, yes, there was new property that came to Reuven, but that was already disposed of and you never were able to exercise your collection rights before it disappeared, the asset, and therefore your lien is not any good. The fact that the Mishnah entertains their claim and it grants a Beit Shammai, their claim is so valid that they get to split it with them, that shows you that there must be a shibud that exists over here. So Amalu Rav Nachman Zira Chavrin Targuma. So Rav Nachman Zira says, Chachamim in the Beit HaMidrash, Targuma explained it in the following manner, Mitzvah Yitomim Lifruach Chavot Aviyen. But over here, this has nothing to do with the Ikne, but rather to another factor, which is that there is a mitzvah There's an obligation upon the Yorshim, the Yitomim over here, the orphans, to repay the outstanding indebtedness of their father. And since they have an obligation to pay it back, this is irrespective as to whether there's ikneh written in the contract or not. Their obligation exists, whether it says that the creditors have this future lien to be extended on the property, and therefore they have this obligation to repay it, and that's the rights of the creditors over here. The rights of the creditors are because there is this obligation upon the Yorshim to repay the indebtedness of their father. So this really doesn't answer our question, because the issue at hand here is not about whether the lien was extended this property or not extended this property, but another mitzvah, which is the obligation of the Yitomim to repay it. Now, the Baal Yotosavot here discuss the nature of that mitzvah, and you can see over here the Baal Yotosavot would say, v'kofin kan. It's not only a mitzvah in the sense of that they should do it, it's a nice thing for them to do, but actually it's a baked-in, enforceable right of the creditors to have the Yitomim pay back the outstanding debtedness of their father. And the Baal Yotosavot over here would say, kofin, Beitin would come in and force them to do this mitzvah, like any other mitzvah tasei that we have in the Torah, where there's a mitzvah tasei, kofinato. We would compel the individual to do that mitzvah tasei. And so through here, we would compel the Yitomim or the inheritors to do what is obligated upon them. But he says that's only in a case where there are achrayut nechasim, and that there's real property that was left in the estate, because then the claims of the creditors or the liens of the creditors exist on those real properties, and then we would obligate them. On the other hand, in a case where he did not leave them real property, we will not be kofer them. But the Baal Yotosafot make a distinction and say the mitzvah still exists in that case. There's still a mitzvah upon the Yitomim to repay their father's indebtedness, but we will not compel them to do it. So in a case where there's achriyut nechasim, where there is real property that was inherited by these individuals, then we would compel them in Beit Din to make the repayment. On the other hand, if there are assets there, but they are not assets of real property, they're metalkalin, they're currency, other items, then they do have the obligation to repay it, but Beit Din would not force them in that case. And there, Tosafot quotes the machloket as to whether the Yitomim have a mitzvah or have an obligation in that case where there are metalkalin, because technically they become their assets, and then they're giving up of their personal assets to repay it. He says, even according to the Mandamar that says they do have to repay it, we would not compel them, we would not be kofinotam in that instance. Ravashi says, wait a minute, milval pehu. Wait a minute, if you are saying here that the obligation to repay the creditors does not stem from the credit note or the outstanding shtar that they have, the claim that they have over here, over the Ktubat Isha that is here, but rather it's an obligation upon the Yitomim to make repayment, then the shtar, in a sense, is meaningless. The shtar has nothing to do with this. The obligation stems from the mitzvah on the Yitomim to repay it. And now it becomes the equivalent of a milveh peh. The Rabu Shmuel d'amrei tarvayu. Both Rav and Shmuel agree. Milveh peh eno goveh lo mina yorshim velo mina lekuchot. When you have an oral loan, a loan that does not have the shtar or the public awareness about it, those loans don't have a right to be collected from encumbered property, and they can't go after yorshim. They can't go after inheritors. They can't go over buyers, because their rights to the assets are only in free and clear assets that are in the possession of that individual who they extended the loan to. And so how can you claim over here that the reason that they're getting repaid is because there's an obligation on the Yorshim? The obligation on the Yorshim is only to repay outstanding indebtedness that came in a shtar. They don't have an obligation to repay indebtedness that stems from a milva peh. And over here, the claim or the rights of the Ktubat Isha or the creditor to get payment does not stem from the shtar. It stems from the fact that we say that it's a mitzvah on the Yitomim to repay, and that makes it the equivalent of an oral loan. And the Rashbam over here just makes a side note that despite the fact that Rav and Shmuel say this, and that is the Ikar Halacha, nevertheless, he says, L'kaman paskina and hilchata milval peh govemini or shim shlo tilnel deli b'fnei levin. That even though that is technically true, nevertheless, the Chachamim instituted that you do have to make repayment of that indebtedness because we want to keep liquidity in the market. And if there's this risk that the creditors will not be able to collect in these situations where the debtor passes away, they're not going to lend money in that fashion. And therefore, there is an obligation to repay it, even though it's a milval peh, even though technically they don't have the rights to make a collection in that situation. But as far as we're concerned, in our case over here, why should there be an obligation upon the Yitomim to repay in this instance? Ella, hamani, you have to say that the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. He That our Mishnah is working with the concept of Iknei. We can't say that it's working because of the mitzvah Yitomim to repay it, because we see there that's a milvah peh. If it's a milvah peh, they would have no obligation to repay them because they are now your shim. And Rav Shmuel said that your shim have no obligation to repay the outstanding oral indebtedness of their father. So we have to go back to what we said before, that the reason that they have to be repaid, these creditors of the Tabati Shelby here, is because their lien extended onto the property of Reuven after Yaakov passed away. So that would be an answer to Shmuel's question. The truth is that it is an answer to his question. The only problem is that it's authored by Rabbi Meir. And we already established through Shmuel's question that according to Rabbi Meir, this isn't a question. Of course, Rabbi Meir believes that you have such a right over here to have the lien extend onto future properties, and then that lien will be strong enough to then take it away from the kuchot or your shim. But the question is, alibi de rabbanan. And since now we've assigned Rabbi Meir to be the author of our Mishnah, we don't have a proof from our Mishnah as to the position of the chachamim. Amar Rabbi Yaakov minar pakud mishmei de Ravina tashma. Bring your proof from a different case. Shtar yechol v'muktabim psugim. If you have a predated shtar, it is pasul. Hamu acharim, if you have a postdated shtar, ksherim. That is fine, that is kasher. So now what you have here is a difference in the dating of the shtar versus the actual extension of the loan. And as the Rashbam points out of here, this is not going according to the position of Abaye in the Gemara of Mitzia that says, Eidah b'chotamav zachin lo. That when the signatories, when the individuals who sign on the document, they're the one who create the lien or the encumbrance, and therefore whenever the shtar is written, that's what generates the encumbrance. We're not using that shita, but rather that the encumbrance is extended at the point of the loan. So the shtar is just evidence to the fact that there was a loan, and the date on the shtar should match the date of the loan. So if you have a shtar that has the same date as the loan, then you have no problem. The problem arises when the shtar is either written prior to the extension of the loan, or even if it's written at the time of the loan, it's predated to the date before the time of the loan, then that is a shtar pasul because it gives rights to the creditor that he shouldn't have, which is that the creditor only gets rights to collect from the property of the debtor from the moment he extended the loan. If you then predate the shtar, he's going to show up and say, I have rights to assets that were sold even before he lent money to the debtor. Say that the debtor on the 1st of Nisan sold some property, and then he borrows money on the 15th of Nisan. So if the debt was marked in the shtar as being given on the 15th of Nisan, then he wouldn't have any rights to the property that was sold on the 1st of Nisan. But now if you predate the shtar and say that the credit was extended on the 1st of Nisan or even before that, all of a sudden he has a right to go after those purchasers of the property on the 1st of Nisan, even though he only extended credit on the 15th of Nisan. So because of that, we considered a shtar mukdam to be pasul. How pasul it is, the Balei Tosafot claim of here, it's pasul the gamrei. It becomes completely invalid. Not only do you not have a right to collect from the predated time in the shtar, you don't even have a right to collect with the shtar from the date of the actual loan. You are penalized now to the point where the shtar is pasul the gamrei. He brings a possibility of reading it otherwise, but he favors helpfully the word pasul, meaning pasul de gamre, similar to what we saw with Rabbi Meir with a document or a loan document that includes interest, where Rabbi Meir says that they were kones, the individual, to say that not only can he not collect on the interest, he cannot even collect the outstanding debt. So it's over here. This individual will lose his shtar completely. The Rambam disagrees and says, yes, it's pasul from the predate, that the shtar is pasul to collect from nechasim shubadim, but it is still kasher as a evidence of the fact that there is a loan and gives you the right to collect from the nechasim b'nei chorim. So it's not pasul the gamrei, hamu acharim. If it's a post-dated shtar, then it's kasher, because the only one who loses in a post-dated shtar is the creditor. The creditor extended credit at a particular date, say for instance here the 15th of Nisan. If the shtar is not written until Sivan or until Tishrei and has that date in it, then his rights to collect from other parties will be delayed. Even though he really had rights from an earlier time, it only hurts him to have the shtar dated later, and then nobody is put out or nobody is at risk for him collecting improperly from them. They actually, it might be to their advantage. Never, we don't worry about a shtar me'uchar. But the reason that Rabbi Yaakov Nark Pakud, Mishum Ravina, brings this down is because then a shtar me'uchar has an interesting impact. Which was, again, let's say a case where he lent him money on the 15th of Nisan, and then he wrote the shtar and dated it for the 1st of Sivan. So he dated it for a month and a half later. In the interim, in Iyar, the debtor goes ahead and acquires property. Now that he's acquired property, when he writes the shtar, starting on the first of Sivan, looking from the perspective of when the shtar is written, the asset that he purchased in Iyar was already in his possession prior to the writing of the shtar. On the other hand, when he extended the credit on the 15th of Nisan, that property was yet to be in his possession. That was a future property. So now, if you say that the shtar mukhar is kasher, what you're allowing to happen now is for him to have an encumbrance on property that only came into his possession after the extension of the loan. The date of the loan is the time that the shibut should start. That's when the encumbrance starts. So now you have assets that were after the extension of the loan, but prior to the writing of the shtar. And we're saying that the shtar is successful at capturing those assets. And that's what he means here. If you believe that if you have the lashon ikne, future properties acquired in the shtar, kana umachar, diikne, kana vehurish, and in a case where ikne, if he purchases it and then sells it, or purchases it and then bequeaths it, lo mishtabed, that there is no shibud, the lien doesn't work, mucharim amayk shirim. Why are the post-dated shtarot considered to be kasher? They can't be kasher because this post-dated shtar seems to indicate that the properties in Iyar are subject to the lien. Well, how could they be subject to the lien? The lien really started on the 15th of Nisan when the actual credit was extended. The only way it works is that if we believe that the credit you extend not only gains you the right to the assets that exist now, but even to assets in the future. And that's why the shtar mukhar would be kasher. I'm like, Shirim, Diknehu, why should the Shtar Mukhar be Kasher? It's the same case, or it's a similar case of Ikne, and that would only be true if you believe that the Shibud does work in that case. Mari answers here again, Hamani, who's the author of that Mishnah? Rabbi Meir, he, Tamar Adam Akne, Devar Shlo Bal Olam. So similar to the way that we explained our Mishnah, we're also going to explain that Mishnah, which is that Rabbi Meir is the author of that position. So once again, if you assign Rabbi Meir authorship of these Mishnayot, then in that case, we have no proof to Shmuel's question. Shmuel agreed that according to Rabbi Meir, it certainly works. Our question was in the position of the Chachamim, does it work? We need to find the Chachamim's position, whereby we can prove that it should work. Amar Rav Mishar, Shemishmei de Rabba, Tashma. Let's try to bring the proof from here. L'shevach karkaot keitzat. So the Mishnah in Bava Metzia deals with how does it work in a situation in which you have shevach, an improvement of property, by which the claimant now can come and take not only away the property, but even the improvements of the property. He sold a plot of land to his friend, and the buyer improved the land. He invested in the land and improved it. And then the creditor of the original owner, of the seller, comes along and takes it away from the buyer. When he takes collection from it, he has a right to go and take the recourse back from the original seller, from the encumbered properties, bet ha-shevach, but the extra value that he put in there, minchasim b'dei chorin. It is only from free and clear property. The Gemara in Bava Metzia has ukimto to explain the situation or exactly how this happened, but let us just say that in a simplistic way to view this, you have A, who sold property to B. B invested a lot of money in that property. Then, all of a sudden, A's creditors show up and say A has no property. The only property that was there was the property that was sold to B. So they come to B and say, please give me back the property. Not only do they collect from the property, they also collect all the shevach. You have to say that here it's an outstanding loan that exceeds the value of the property and exceeds the value of the shevach, and therefore they're going to collect everything. They take away the property and the shevach that's on top of it. The Gemara Bava Metzia discusses why you have a right to that, and that it was exela, there was theft involved. But just to keep the case simplistic, we're just going to say there was a case where A sold it to B, and then A's creditors come and take it away from B. So now B is out not only the cost of his property, he's out all the investment he made in the property. So now B says to A, listen, you sold me that property with recourse. You sold me with the right to come back and make a claim. If the property's taken away, you're going to replace it. So now B says to A, pay me back not only the money that I paid you for the property, but all the money I invested in that property. Well, here, the Mishnah says that he has rights to go after A for the principal amount, even from encumbered property, because that's something that other lenders after him could assess. They knew that he bought the property, and they knew they had recourse against the seller. He had recourse against A, and so then when they were sizing up A's assets, they could know, or they could understand, how much room to leave in A's assets to protect themselves. And if they did so, then they should be protected. If they didn't, then they assumed that risk and they could lose their property. So B has a right to go after A for his principal amount. But the shevach the additional investment that he made, he can go after the free and clear property of A. He cannot go after encumbered property of A. That's based on a Mishnah on Kubot, which says that you may not collect Shevach from encumbered property. And that is basically a Takanat Chachamim, which says that when it comes to Shevach, it is two things. One is that it's an immeasurable amount. It is something that you cannot assess properly because you never know how much is going to be invested in the property, as well as the fact that it's something that the lenders that come afterwards will not be necessarily aware of or know how to deal with. For those reasons, the Mishnah Kubot says that you can't go after encumbered property to collect your Shevach, because that would then undermine the market. People would never lend money because they say, okay, I can assess how much he has outstanding in indebtedness, how many properties he sold with recourse, but I can't tell how much is going to be invested in those properties that might be taken away, and then he might have unlimited liabilities, which I can't assess, and then there it would shut down the market. So for that reason, you can't collect Shevach from properties that are encumbered. So this B here, who sold the property, can come back and make a claim against A, number one, for his principal amount, even from encumbered property, for Shevach, from free and clear property. The Baal Tosafot would ask over here, if there is free and clear property for him to collect from, then why didn't the creditor of A take the free and clear property? He has to go to that first. So either you have to say here that that free and clear property only showed up after he took the property away from B, or you have to say there's a case where it's an aputiki, that he had a directed lien against the property that was sold from A to B, and for that reason he took that property and didn't have to worry about whether A had free and clear assets. And now this is the proof from here, that if you think if you think when you have included in the document this ikne that future assets will be uncovered, that means that even assets that are bought and sold, even assets that are bought and then bequeathed, then why has the Bachov have a right to go after the Shevach? The Shevach is an asset that only existed or came into existence at a later time. The Baal Chov, when he lent them the money, the only thing was there was the underlying property. The Shevach was created by B when he invested in the property. That's an asset that was created after the extension of the loan. So you see there that he does have a lien, or he does have a right of collection against a future asset. And here he's collecting not only the principal, but even the Shevach. He's taking all of that for the outstanding indebtedness. And that's something or an asset that came in the future. And that's an asset in the future that's now encumbered. It was sold to another party who made the investment. And nevertheless, the creditor has a right to it. So that would prove that you do have a case here where Ikne is successful at establishing a lien, even on encumbered properties, and he's still allowed to grab it. My answer is the same thing over here as it did in the previous two cases. Hamani, Rabbi Meir, Damar Adam Makne Devash Lo Baleulam. Once again, this is authored by Rabbi Meir, who says that a person has a right to collect even from things that don't exist. And again, Shmuel's question assumed that Rabbi Meir would think this works. Our question is in the position of the Chachamim. So in all these instances, we're saying that Rabbi Meir is the author of the Mishnayot. It's not far-fetched to say, Stam Mishnah Rabbi Meir he. So that's not far-fetched, as well as the fact that we just don't know. And therefore, you can always, just as a way, assign the authorship to Rabbi Meir. And that's it. We don't know what the Chachamim say. You can't prove from this Mishnayot what the position of the Chachamim is. So now the Gemara says, Imtim Salomar. The Gemara says, okay, we don't have any proof as to which way we should go here, but let us make an assumption. If you want to say, if you include in the original debt document the fact that future assets will be encumbered, that language, Tanau Machar, Diknei, Tanabahu Rish, in the instance where you have that language in, and there were assets that came in the future and then were sold or bequeathed, Lo Mishtabe, you are not successful extending a Shibun on that. Ha, lo mishtabet. In that case, then there's nothing to speak about. You're unsuccessful at extending that lien onto those properties, and the creditor won't have any rights to go after them. Imtim salomar. But on the other hand, if you do conclude, de mishtabet, that you are successful at extending a lien in that situation, let me pose to you the following question, which is, lava, vilava, he borrowed money from one creditor, he borrowed money from a second creditor, v'chazar, v'kana. And then afterwards, he acquired assets. Mahu, what is the din there? Which of the two creditors has a right to that future asset? Lekama mishtabet, do we say that the future asset goes to the first creditor first? He was first in line over here. And we're saying now that when you extend credit to an individual, your lien extends not only to his existing assets, but even to future assets. because that's the imtim salomar. If you want to say that that is true, then when he extends that lien, does his lien then become the priority lien? Because in this situation, the asset wasn't there. The assets that are there, it's clear that the first creditor has first lien or first rights to it. On the other hand, the asset that came in later, both of them had already extended credit. So at that moment, their lien both extend. Both the first creditor and the secondary liens are there. And then their liens will attach themselves to the new property that is acquired simultaneously. Because at the point that it was acquired, both of them are there. So the question is, does the first one have rights to it? Because just like his lien takes priority on existing assets, so too his lien will take priority on assets that are acquired. Hold a bacha mishtabe. Or does it go to the second party? Over here, the Rashbam explains this in a way that I think is difficult, and I would opt to explain it differently. The Rashbam says that it would go entirely to the second creditor. Since the second creditor is the more recent of those liens, therefore, property that's acquired, he'll have first rights to it because it's as if the first person's lien was somehow subordinated to the second creditor. And because of that, the new assets will go to the second creditor first rather than the first creditor. I would have just stated that it doesn't mean the batra exclusively, but it means that they both have rights. And that seems to be the way the Gemara is reading it as we go on, the solution to the problem of why or how we deal with this situation. So I would just say that it doesn't mean the batra exclusively, but it means also to the batra. Since both of their liens exist already, and the new asset came in, both of their liens happened simultaneously, and therefore they would share in that property. That's not the way the Rishbam learns. Other Rishonim do learn that way, but that's not the way the Rishbam learns. Amar of Nachman, how milta ibayilan? We had this question, Bishachu mitam, and they said from Eretz Yisrael, Bishon kana, that the first one is koneh, that just like his lien is priority when it comes to the existing assets, so to his lien will be priority when it comes to new assets that come into the estate. Rav Huna amar, yachloku. Then Rav Huna says that they split it. Vefeintana rabba barabua, yachloku, that both the first creditor and the second creditor will split it. So now, over here, you could say that yachloku for one of two reasons. You could say yachloku, like the way the Rashbam explains it, because you have a safek over here. You don't know whether it's the first individual who has the lien, according to the Rashbam, whether the second individual has the lien. I mean, that both, according to the Rashbam, they're both exclusive rights. Either the first one gets it because he has the first lien here, or the second one gets it because he's the latter lien, and we're not sure as to whom it belongs. And therefore, we're going to split it because we have uncertainty over here. That's one way to read the yachloku. Or the other way to read the yachloku is because of what I stated before. It's a conclusion. The conclusion is here, yachloku, not because it's a safek, but yachloku because that is the actual din. The din is that they have equal rights now to future assets because their liens are both extant at the point that those new assets come into the possession of the debtor. And therefore, they extend their rights equally at that moment. And the Rishonim bring nafkaminot with regards to whether you classify it as a safek or not in cases of tfisa, where one of the two parties grabs it. Do you have a right to take it back from them? So that will depend on whether you read this as a conclusive psak, which is that they both own it because their liens happen simultaneously, versus if you have a situation in which it's a safek. In cases of safek, there are rights that are acquired by the individuals depending on how strong their claim is in the safek. In addition, when it comes to the splitting of the asset here, or the lien on this asset, there are two ways to do it. You could just say yachloku, that they each have 50% of the rights to this asset, or you could say that they have rights to this asset based on the size of their claims. And we will give them a relative distribution of this lien based on the size of their loan, so that their liens will both be extended to this property, but in a measure that equates their relative loan amounts. So those are two, also another discussion in the Rishonim as to how to divide it up. And you can see that in the Rashbam, he says, that each one, according to his credit that's outstanding, we will give him. It's not a 50-50 split, rather a split along the lines of the amount of credit that's being extended by the two parties. Because the batachad nishtabdu lahem, because it happens simultaneously. So it's interesting here, the Rashbam, who himself explains that the safek is either that the first one to get it entirely or the second one to get it entirely, he says that the psak of yachloku is not a safek psak, which is what the Ramban says, but rather it's a definitive psak, which is that since they both are there at the time that the asset was acquired, they both have equal rights to it. So according to the Rashbam, that really turns out that this is a third possibility as to how to read or to bring a solution to this question. And the Baal HaTosafot do point out that you could have asked this question even if you believe that Ikne is not successful at establishing future liens, a situation in which he acquired assets in the future but did not sell them off or did not bequeath them. What we said originally in the Gemara, that's pshita, that he has a lien on that property. Again, if he had two creditors that lent money, and then only after the fact an asset came into the estate, which remains in the estate, does their lien extend to that asset? What's the priority of the lien? So Tosafot says you could have asked the question even according to one that says lo mishtabe, and even though the Gemara says imtim salomar, that's lo mishtabe, then this question is not relevant. It's just not really true. You could come up with a case, but the Balei Tosafot say, since topically our Gemara is dealing with a case where the new asset came in and then he disposed of it, because that's our major question, therefore the Gemara set up the question in a manner which only addresses that issue, and not this other issue where you could come up with a case that even if you believe that there is no Shibud over here, you could still have this question be relevant because it's a case where the asset wasn't disposed of after it came into the estate, post the liens of the two creditors. Okay, Amar Ravina. Ravina says, Madura Kamo, in the first instance, the Ravashi Amarlan, Ravashi told us at that time, Rishon Kana, that the Rishon has the rights. Madura Batro, in the second version, the Ravashi Amarlan, Yachloku. Ravashi says that Yachloku, the Hilchatan, the Halucha is Yachloku. Because over here we have Ladra Muraim, all saying the Yachloku, plus you have Ravashi, in his second version, saying Yachloku, and therefore the Halucha is Yachloku. Now, the Rishbam explains, that means that the first time Ravashi taught us the sugya, he said Rishon Kana. The second time he taught us the sugya, he said Yachloku. So he changed his mind the second time that he learned through the sugya. On the other hand, the Rishbam quotes from the Rabbeinu Hananel that Ravashi learned, lived for 60 years, and his first 30 years he went through all his learning, and then again he reviewed all of his learning in the second 30 years. And that's what it means, Madura Kama, Madura Vatra. Madura Kama means the first time he learned everything in his first 30 years. Madura Batra means that the second time he learned everything in his second 30 years of his life. Although, again, the Rishbam simply just says it's a case where he went through it twice. It's not about how long he lived or what part of his life, or he only went over things twice. Rather, when he was reviewing it, he taught us the first time he mentioned Rishon Kana. The second time he taught us, he said Yachloku, and that is the halokha that it is Yachloku. Meitavei, the Shevach Karkaot Ketzat. In a case of Shevach Karkaot, this is the case from Baba Metzia that we mentioned before. Haresh Macharsa Dele Chaviro, he sold off the property to his friend. And then this individual improves the property. And then the creditor comes, creditor of A comes and takes away the property from B, who purchased it from A. Not only does he take away the property, he takes away all the investment he made in the property. And he goes to get the principal amount of the property back because it was sold to him with recourse. He goes back to A to get that money back. He can take that money back for the principal amount even from encumbered property, even from items that were sold post his purchase of the property, or items that were given away post the selling of the property to him, but the shevach, but the investment that he made in the property and the improvements that he made in the property, nechasim b'nei chorim, he can only have to go after free and clear property. Vimito, if you are right, that in the case of de'ikne, future assets that come in, you get a lien, which now gives you yachloku, that you will split it, chatzi shevach mibayle, he should be entitled to half the shevach over here. This situation actually turns out to be exactly the case that we were just speaking about. Over here you have A, who is indebted to a creditor. That creditor has the first lien here because he lent the money first. Post that extension of the loan, A sells some of his property to B. So B now becomes, quote-unquote, the second creditor. Because when he sold, A sold the property to B, he sold it with recourse. And that recourse entitles B now to have a claim against A. So now you have creditor of A, and then you have B, who becomes a creditor of A because of the recourse over here. So now, these two creditors are vying for the assets of A. Now, as far as the property is concerned, creditor number one clearly has precedence because that asset existed at the time that he extended the loan, and therefore he can go take away the property from B because he's the first creditor. But when it comes to the shevach, to the improvements in the property and investment made in the property, that's an asset that came post the extension of credit to these two parties. The lien of creditor to A, as well as the lien of B, who was sold the property of recourse, now both exist at the time the shevach is created. They are now both creditors to A, and in that meaning, that means that their liens should be of equal rights. And that means when the creditor of A comes and takes away the property from B, she better take away the principal property and only half of the shevach, assuming that their astounding loans are equal according to their Shbam. According to others, it doesn't matter. It could be 50-50. You should only be entitled to 50% of the shevach because that's a new asset. And now creditors have equal rights of liens onto new assets. There's no precedence given to a first creditor versus a second creditor. And so why are you telling us that all the shevach goes to the creditor of A, the first creditor? It should be split between these two creditors now. Gemara says, my gova nami dekani. But it says over there that the creditor gets to collect it, chatzi shevach. That's what it should have said. It doesn't mean that he gets all the shevach. It means that he gets to collect the shevach or his rights to the shevach, which is only 50%. And in Okanami, the loch is yachloku. And therefore, in that case, the creditor of A would only get rights to take away the principal property from B, as well as half of the shevach. The other half of the shevach will remain with B, and then he'll get to make a claim against A for the principal amount, even from the nechasim mishubadim. And the other half of his shevach, he will only get a claim or get to take away from B's free and clear property. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots at the end of Kufnin and Zion and Beth. I'm going to note this here, and I'll note it again in the beginning of tomorrow's daf, that both the Bali Tosafot over here, as well as the Rashbam on tomorrow's daf, note that the Gemara actually does not continue on the top of Kufnun Chet Amud Aleph with the Mishnah, but actually continues with the Gemara on the bottom of Kufnun Chet Amud Bet. And all of that Gemara is Shayach to our Mishnah, and it should be before the next Mishnah that's here. The Bali Tosafot and the Rashbam say that, and they quote the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananu that had it that way. We, because of the way that the Gemara is laid out, are going to end up doing the next Mishnah, and then only in 2 days from now, doing the Gemara that is a continuation of here. It's not necessarily a direct continuation, but it's a continuation because it uses our Mishnah as a proof text, and therefore it's relevant to our Mishnah, not to the subsequent Mishnayot.